Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we will be discussing The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin. You're listening to the first edition of History in Reverse. My name is Caroline, and I'm here with my father, Richie.
Hi.
So we're here today starting our first podcast, first science fiction podcast. And so it's the first one, so we should probably go over some of the basics. So we named the podcast History in Reverse, and that was your idea, Dad. So you want to explain what that title means?
Right. So basically, the way I thought about it is that when you read history, you read stuff that happened back in time. When you read science fiction, read the stuff that will happen in the future. So it's history in reverse.
Yes, exactly. So we're trying to do these podcasts pretty regularly where we're going to read some science fiction piece and analyze it together and discuss it. We're both really into science fiction. I blame that on my father for getting me into science fiction.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So just a little bit about us, just because it's the first podcast. So my name's Caroline. I'm a lawyer, and I love reading and watching science fiction. I'm a big Star Trek person. I've been rewatching Voyager recently, and I've read a bunch of science fiction throughout my life, but a lot of the pieces we're reading, I'll be reading for the first time, like the one we're doing today, whereas I think you've read a lot of these things already. So why don't you talk about yourself a bit?
So I started reading science fiction when I was a teenager, like 12 or something. Mm-hmm. And my favorite author is actually Stanislaw Lem, whom we'll get to eventually.
Yes, you will make me read Lem.
That's one of the purposes of this podcast. And only fairly recently, I started actually reading history and kind of discovered that there's big similarity by reading history and reading science fiction, because the stories are well-written histories. The stories are fascinating. Mm-hmm. And you know, science fiction kind of explores some ideas that might happen in that same kind of a context. So, anyway.
Yeah, so you've read, like, tons and tons of science. You've read a lot more science fiction than I have.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were there when, like, Star Wars was happening and
right.
Star Trek was happening. And actually, I think when I was a kid, I first got into Star Trek because Voyager was airing.
Right, we watched Voyager together.
Yeah.
And I turned into a Trekkie.
Yes, that is
You're
how
welcome.
It happened. We got to go to a Star Trek convention. That'd be great.
Yeah.
So for today, we read Ursula Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness. Miss Le Guin just passed away recently, so we thought it'd be good to read one of her books and see what, you know, her legacy and everything like that. And this is my first time reading it, and I think you've read it before, right?
Right. So I've read this book a long time ago, and I remember liking it. I reread it fairly recently, and then what I've been doing lately, which I discovered accidentally, is listening to audiobooks, especially of books I've read. And the thing I find that when you hear a book and when you read it, you notice different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so recently I listened to the audiobook of Left Hand of Darkness, and I also listened to a BBC production of Left Hand of Darkness as a radio show. It was kind of interesting as well. We'll talk about that more.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Ursula Le Guin herself. You read up a little bit about it, and you've read other books of hers, so why don't you talk about that?
Right, so she was born in 1929 and only died in January of this year, 2018. And in the introduction, in the little description that exists in the Left Hand of Darkness that we have, they mentioned that her father was an anthropologist and her mother was a writer. So,
mm-hmm.
which kind of...
That kind of makes sense.
Kind of makes
sense.
Yeah,
with like the way she writes, yeah.
So the books of hers that I've read was Left Hand of Darkness, which we'll talk about a lot today. There's a book called Lathe of Heaven that she wrote, which is a kind of very interesting book in the style of Philip K. Dick, if anything.
Oh, wow.
And it was actually made into a movie on PBS, which is available on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
The other book that she's well known for is something called The Dispossessed, which is another political kind of intrigue type of a thing between planets. And another book of hers that I've read is called The Word for the World is Forest, which is actually, I think, was an inspiration for the movie Avatar, you know, the one with the big, tall, blue people.
Yeah, blue people avatar and the forest, right? Because the world is like, and that the world is all forest and everything.
Right. Now she has written a whole bunch of other stuff. There's a whole bunch of stuff that she wrote, which is called a series of Wizard of Air and Sea or something like that. Earth and Sea, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And I have not read any of that stuff. And because it sounds like fantasy, but from what I'm hearing, it's not quite. But I'm not that interested in fantasy, so I've never read it before.
Mm-hmm. I might like that. Mm-hmm. I'm into the fantasy stuff.
And so in the introduction to this book, introduction by the author, she talks about what it is to write science fiction, which I kind of liked what she said. And she essentially said that science fiction is not for predicting the future, but she thought of it as a thought experiment. So you imagine some kind of thing, and then you try to build a story around it, imagine how things might work.
Mm-hmm.
And this is quotation from her introduction, says, goal is not to predict the future, but to describe reality.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of similar to something somebody once said about art in general, that artists tell lies to expose the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very true. It's not possible really to predict the future, so why would you try to write something about it? Like, and that's not interesting. Who really cares? You know,
we want to. Well, actually, that's funny because that's the point that she makes in the introduction. She says, like, you know, yeah, you can try to predict and stuff, but it's boring.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, that's kind of what the foretellers do in the story too, and I guess we'll get to that. So yeah. She sort of works that into the story as well. So that's Ursula Le Guin. Obviously, she's written a lot of things. So as for Left Hand of Darkness, obviously there's going to be spoilers. We're talking about the book. If you haven't read it and you want to stop now and go read it, we'll still be here.
Right.
But if not, we're going to give like a very brief summary. So we're introduced to a world called Gethin. And at the pronunciation's on the audiobook.
Yeah, that sounds okay. Right. Yeah.
So I haven't listened to the audiobook, so I'm basing it on what I read. But if there's a particular way to pronounce things, just let me know. The world's called Gethin. It was also called Winter. And it seems like humans have gone there to try to get the humanoid species that's living on Gethin to join in their sort of like.
So why is it called Winter?
Because it's really cold there. It's got lots of snow. There's ice and snow and blizzards, and it's really cold. And there's no flying animals, apparently. And I don't know. You can't fly in the snow. But yeah, so the what was it called? The Ecumen?
Right. So the kind of backstory is that there's Ecumen, which is a federation of 80 planets.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to bring a new planet into the Ecumen. And the way they do it is by sending an envoy, just one person, to that planet to try to convince them to join.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this book does not have any faster than light space travel, so it takes a while to get from place to place. But it has the Ansible, which is, I think it was Ursula Le Guin who kind of quote-unquote invented it, which mm-hmm. is a communication device that is instant.
That pops up in Ender's Game too, right? Something like
that. Yeah, I think that's where he borrowed it from there, and that appears in the world. The word for the world is forest, and a few other places. But this is if you want to go to quantum physics, there is some possible theories that you can maybe do communications, instantaneous communication between any part, in two points in the universe.
Mm-hmm. It's science fiction magic, basically.
Yeah, tech.
Tech. So he's the guy who goes to the surface is named Genli Ai. A lot of the Gethinians can't pronounce his name, so for part of the book he's called Genri Ai. They can't pronounce L's in one of the countries. And he's just sort of chilling, trying to convince the government to join the Ecumen and have the planet join the Ecumen to be part of this coalition for everybody's benefit. And it's an interesting strategy, I think, as opposed to like declaring war on the planet and taking it over or sending troops or sending like a military something over there.
Right. They're actually, somebody asks him why there's only just one of you, and mm-hmm. it's just not to be threatening.
Right, exactly. It's like if it's just him, he's a curiosity. If there's two or more, then it's an invasion.
Right.
So he goes, and the story picks up when he's been there for about 2 years, and he's finally got an audience with the Mad King of one of the countries, of Karhide. And then the shenanigans that follow therefrom. He's helped by, was Estravan the prime minister?
So Estravan was a prime minister who was trying to kind of help him to get the audience with the king and kind of get them to agree to join the Ecumen and whatever. but Genli doesn't quite trust him. So he's there's a lot of kind of like palace intrigue apparently happening.
Yeah, that's the thing. It was difficult as a reader, and maybe that's because we're human and we're not Gathenian. It was difficult to sort of grasp some of that palace intrigue. But we'll talk about what's Schiffgrether a little bit. But basically, Estravan, is that how you say it? Estravan?
Yeah.
Gets exiled, and then Genli realizes that he meets with the king, and the king's not willing to join
King is not
him.
That interested. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then Genli travels to another country on the planet.
Orgorin?
It's like Orgorin. How do they say it?
Orgorin.
Orgorin. So it's spelled really weird. And he travels there to see if...
interesting part about that country, there's different kind of government. They have these guys called commensals.
Right.
So it's more like multi-party parliamentary kind of a thing.
Yeah, it
happening.
Seems more bureaucratic. There's more... structure in a different sort of way. And the two countries, Carhide and Orgorin, are sort of never at war, because one of the things the Gathenians won't go to war with each other because they don't seem to know what war is. But they're sort of opposites. They're sort of always competing with each other.
Somewhat, yeah.
So that's when he goes to the foretellers, I think, right? Is that point?
Yeah, before going to Orgorin.
Right, so he goes
to... So before we get into all of that stuff, what is so different about Gathenians?
Oh, of course. I totally forgot. The Gathenians don't have gender in the same way humans do. So the word that Ursula Le Guin uses, she describes the humans as being bisexual. That's not what the word really means now. And I'm not sure the word really ever meant that. But what she means by that is that there are two distinct biological genders for humans. So there's male and female. Gathenians exist in a state of what does she call it? Ambisexuality, or like a state where they're basically gender neutral, except for like a couple days during the month where they're potentially sexually active. And if they become sexually active with another Gathenian, one will take on the traits of the male and one will take on the traits of the female.
The one that takes traits of the female can become pregnant and bear a child.
Right, exactly. And then will remain pregnant for the duration of having the child and nursing the child. But then they will revert back to being gender neutral, and they can go either way. So you can, have one cycle where a Gathenian is male, and then the very next cycle that Gathenian is female. It just sort of depends on who they pair with, seems like.
And that's called Kemmer.
Kemmer, yes. And there's all kinds of societal rules about Kemmer and who you can Kemmer with.
Well, there's some rules, but they also have these Kemmer houses. So like when the time strikes... You can just go and pair off with somebody.
Yeah. And everybody gets like a week off for it. Like each time. I want that week off. I think we should have that. But yeah, so I mean, that's what's really unique about them.
So kind of, I guess, maybe jumping ahead a little bit. But in the book, there's like hints at why such a species evolved in the first place. And I guess Genli Ai kind of seems to indicate that maybe this wasn't a real evolution but experiment.
Right.
By, I mean, the civilization has existed there for a few thousand years. So he claims there's some evidence that there was some genetic experiments done to see if such a civilization could exist without war.
Right, exactly. And so there's some indication that there was like a native species to Gethin, that humans like set down a colony and interbred with, or something along those lines. So the implication from Genli's point of view being that there's a relationship between humans and Gathenians.
Now, this is something that came up when we were talking about the book. I didn't actually notice that part about the species.
It's very
stuff.
Quick. Yeah, it's very. I think I highlighted it. I have an actual physical copy of the book that I highlighted with a real highlighter. So I think I highlighted it somewhere. But yeah, no, they do say it's at the chapter that talks about it being an experiment that there was that. But
so the political situation though at the point where the book takes place, the two countries, Carhide and Orgorin, are kind of having some border conflicts, and there's some indication that it might escalate further.
Yeah, they're having, I forgot the name of the area they're having the dispute over.
Right.
It's got some weird S name, I don't remember.
Right.
But they're having some like border dispute, and
I also like the description of Carhide that they give. What Carhide is not really a country, but a family quarrel.
Yeah. Because it seems it also sort of indicated that the Githenians, their civilization sort of, I guess, progressed to a point, but then seems to have plateaued.
Right.
Like, they don't have a lot of advanced technology.
Well, they have the technology that's advanced is for how to survive in the cold. So
right.
The like, one of the little things that she mentioned is that houses have winter doors.
Yeah.
Right.
Which are the doors up top on the second floor.
Up high on second floor because there's so much snow.
Right. Which is cute. And I mean, with the snow we've been getting here, we probably need that. So then the Genli goes to the foretellers, which is an interesting part of the story. And more basically, the foretellers are like a little group of people that if you pay them something, they'll answer you a question that can tell the future. And they seem to always be right. And he pays like 2 rubies or something and asks if Gethin, as the planet, is going to join the Ekumen within the next 5 years. And they do their little magical foretelling, which is a really interesting process.
Right.
It seems to be sort of semi-telepathic
right.
to an extent. They answer him yes, that the planet will join the Ekumen within 5 years. And this is sort of where she gets in that bit of philosophy we were talking about earlier with the, you know, science fiction being a thought experiment, and you know, why would you bother wanting to predict the future? Because the sort of theme that Genli takes away from the foretellers is that it's totally useless to have an answer to the wrong question.
Right. So, like, throughout the book, which is kind of nice, there's these little stories or legends from the history of Gethin, from mythology mm-hmm. of Gethin. So
right.
the one about the foretellers is the guy who asks, when will I die? And they tell him, you will die on the 19th day of the month.
Right. It's totally useless.
He gets very upset.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think
or she.
Oh, I don't know. Genli refers to everybody as he, unless... Does he refer to any of the Athenians as she, actually?
Sometimes when they're, like, in the...
If they're, Kemmer, yeah. But he reverts to he, which I think is pretty realistic for... At least for Western humans. So, like, European and, like, American humans. I'm not so sure what, like...
Genli actually is a tall black man, so...
Right, so that's an interesting question, is, like, where is Genli... I mean, it's so far in the future, but, I mean, like, one of the questions would be, like, where is Genli from? Like, is he...
Well, he said he was born on Earth, but, I mean,
right.
he basically joined the service, essentially,
right.
to be an envoy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because of the time travel, you know, because it takes so long to go between stars, basically, by the time he gets to winter, you know, so many years have passed on Earth. So.
Right, yeah, he mentions, like, his parents have been dead for a long time,
yeah,
right, because of
yeah.
the traveling and everything. So, but I do think it's natural, at least for Western cultures, to revert to the masculine,
yeah.
right? And so I thought that was, in terms from his point of view, that made sense. I thought that was a call that made sense and sort of spoke to Genli's own
mm-hmm.
prejudices. Yeah, exactly, and his assumptions. So he goes to the foretellers, and what does he do? He goes to Ogorin?
Right, so what happens is after the audience with the king, basically he gets nowhere, so he... Somebody tells him you should go visit this other country, Ogorin, maybe you can get better luck there. And the background story is his Estrovan, who was the prime minister who was helping him, gets all of a sudden exiled. And the way the exile works in Karhide, you have 3 days to leave the country or they kill you.
Right.
So Estrovan also goes to Ogorin.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, they kind of come in contact there.
Mm-hmm.
And Genli talks to the commensals, trying to convince them. One of the things he reveals, which, you know, he's been showing the Ansible
mm-hmm.
to people, but they say, oh, it could be just a magic trick.
Mm-hmm.
Although they did have scientists analyze his, like, you know, his spaceship.
His ship and everything, yeah.
And his biology, so they know, they kind of call him a pervert because he's always in camera. Because
right,
because
he's always male.
So he reveals to the commensals that there's another spaceship in the orbit around the sun,
mm-hmm.
and he can bring it down to kind of show that he's telling the truth,
mm-hmm.
and some of them get all excited, thinking that, you know, being able to do that will gain a political advantage, and advantage of a Karhide. But Ogorin has the secret police that controls everything,
mm-hmm.
so it's there's like a little bit of kami kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
kami as in communist, going on there, and I guess the secret police deems him a threat, and they just kidnap him
mm-hmm.
and send him to this. Voluntary farm.
Yeah, the farm. The lovely little farm that he's on.
Which is a place where you do some work and where Githenians barely can survive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're much better, I guess, built and adapted to deal with
the cold, yeah.
And then what happens, I guess this is a big spoiler, right? So Estrovan, through some machinations, rescues him.
Magical rescue.
And then they have to decide what to do. So what they decide, that the thing that makes most sense is for them to go back to Korhide.
They're going back to try to contact his ship, right? Is that the idea?
Well, to contact his ship, he needs access to the radio. So like when he is arrested, they take away all his stuff, including the Ansible and whatever. And the plan that they come up with is that they can go over to Korhide, bring the ship down, and kind of Korhide will kind of be, it'll be prestigious for Korhide, that King will kind of go along with it because it's going to increase his whatever. But
Shivgrether,
right?
We'll
so you can explain that. And when they just trying to figure out how to do that without being caught, because he's an escapee from prison and they have no papers, travel papers or whatever, so they can't use roads, and it's winter, and so they decide
they
to actually
take a ship, right? Because it's winter,
because the seas are frozen. So they decide the way to go. There's essentially, I guess, in the North or South Pole, there's a big glacier that they can cross.
I thought of it as the North Pole. I don't know if they actually said.
Yeah, they didn't. I don't think they did. I also thought of it as North Pole, but this could be just our Northern Hemisphere prejudice.
Yeah.
That's, I guess, the last third of the book is the trip across.
Yeah, so that's one of the things you said when you were rereading it. The first time you read it, you thought that the part out in the ice was a much longer portion.
Right.
It is actually a pretty long portion. So the copy of the book I have is 300 pages, and they get out on the ice on page 200. So it's a pretty substantial portion of the story, though not the majority, but it's at least a third of it where they're out on the ice. And I think those chapters are fantastic.
Yeah.
I think they're like really
well, that's what
amazing.
I remembered, like when I thought about the book from reading it before, that's the part that sticks in your head.
Well, and you were saying that the BBC play structured it differently?
Right, so besides listening to the audiobook, I listened to a BBC play, radio play of the book. And the way they structured it was it starts when they're on the ice and they're doing flashbacks to various different things.
I like that structure. I think that's good. I don't know if that would have worked in the book version because of how... I mean, then you would have been playing with a timeline along with playing with all these words and all these other issues. But I like the idea. If they were to make it into a movie or something, that would be a great way to structure it. But yeah, so then they're out on the ice. It's really cold and they're trying to survive and it takes them 80 days or something like that. It's like 800 miles trekking through snow and past volcanoes and dragging things along and everything. And they become like really good bros on this trip.
Well, it's I would go beyond that. So
yeah.
that's also like the interesting thing about this story is because they're longer than a month. And somebody goes in the camera, and somebody starts looking like a beautiful woman, but they don't. Doesn't go any further than that.
Yeah, yeah. I think I would have highlighted a passage about it. Yeah. So basically that's the thing, and it's sort of called. I mean, the whole time, I think one of the things that Genley's been struggling with throughout the story is like, how does he deal with his masculinity in a society that really doesn't care about his masculinity?
Yeah,
it has no
meaning. Yeah,
yeah, it has.
So yeah, like for example, when he's trying not to cry, right?
Right.
Because that's not a manly thing to do.
Right.
But on Geffen, that doesn't make sense.
It's like what does that mean? Like there's no masculine or feminine. There's just you being in Kemmer or you being not in Kemmer. So yeah, so I highlighted a part while they were on this trip, and this is sort of when they sort of. They don't say it out loud that like they're sexually attracted to each other.
No, there's a part when Estravan says, "Please don't touch me."
Yeah, yeah. This is this part. That's what I'm talking about. He says, "I must not touch you," and so Genley sort of talks about it, and he talks about how they're sort of closer now than they've ever been. But if they were to touch, that would sort of ruin everything. So he says, "For us to meet sexually would be for us to meet once more as aliens." We had touched in the only way we could touch. We left it at that. I do not know if we were right. So it's sort of interesting because he's saying they touched in the sense that they touched emotionally.
Yeah, it's like a platonic love story.
Right,
which is one of the things I really like that about this.
Right,
book.
But it's like if they had physically touched each other, it would have been apparent that they were alien to each other,
right.
And then that would have almost separated them in a way again, which I thought was interesting. So yeah, I mean that they're on the ice. They become really good bros.
Or sisters.
or whatever. and they do ultimately make it to Korhide.
Right.
And then explain the death, because I don't understand it. I didn't get what happened.
So, remember, he was exiled from Korhide. And basically, if you come back, you get killed, right? So the death penalty. So if you come back, unless the king lifts it.
Right.
So somebody, they were able to kind of anonymously kind of spend some time in Korhide,
mm-hmm.
but then somebody, there must have been a prize on his head, so mm-hmm. that they, somebody gave him in, and the guy who was the prime minister,
Taib, is how you pronounce Taib. It?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sent border agents after them, and they caught up with them.
But they, so they're like,
and they shot him.
I highlighted a line, because right before they shoot Estevan, spoiler, Estevan's dead, right before they shoot Estevan, he and Genli sort of like cuddle in the forest. We huddled in the dark hollow under dark trees in the snow. We lay right together for warmth. So they like cuddle for a bit. And then, mm-hmm. and then I don't really get it, because Estevan sort of like skis into...
Well, he's trying to get across to the border.
Oh, and he gets caught basically. Basically, yeah, yeah. Oh, I see.
Because he was trying to just cross to the other country.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe he wanted to die. I don't know.
I don't know. He was really confused. So one of the things that happens with them on the ice is that Genli uses this power, teaches him the power of mind speak.
So you want to talk about mind speak?
Yeah. So mind speak's really cool. This is one of the cool science fiction ideas that comes up along with the Ansible. Mind speak's basically telepathy.
Right.
It's like human-based telepathy. They can talk to each other in their thoughts. And the idea with that being that there's no secrets.
Right.
If you're reading someone's mind, if they're reading your mind, you can't
keep. But it is voluntary, so it's like you have to actually speak to somebody and they have to answer it. If somebody doesn't want to speak to you with their mind, you can't just reach in and pull stuff out.
Yeah, exactly. So the Gethenians, Genli believes pretty early on, after watching the foretellers, that the Gethenians would be capable of mind speak. And this is one of the other pieces of evidence, I think, that supports the idea that they're related to the humans somehow. That they would have the same ability.
Right, right.
Though there are problems with that theory, and we'll talk about that. But, so Genli teaches Estevan mind speak.
Or Pence attempts to teach him, and then teach him a little bit.
Mm.
But what happens that's really interesting, especially in the audiobook, is the speech that comes out in Estevan's head is in the voice of his brother.
Right.
So Estevan has a brother that he loved who's dead now, for mm-hmm. whatever reason, and when Genli speaks to him and finally gets through, it comes in the voice of the brother, and Estevan kind of freaks out.
Right. Yeah, that's creepy. I get that. That's creepy. I was wondering, because some people say that Estevan committed suicide, and that was, like, bad, because they don't like that. But so it's sort of like...
Well, no, actually, suicide was a taboo on that world, so
yeah.
you know, it was worse than pretty much anything else.
Yeah.
Right?
So yeah, Estevan definitely had been going through some pretty serious emotional trauma, I guess. He had gone through some in his life with his brother and everything. And then, you know, getting to the point where he can... They do this big trek, which is very difficult. They barely make it. They barely make it with the food they have. And
good luck.
Yeah, and he falls into, like, a crevasse or something at some point, right? Yeah. So very, very scary.
Yeah, so, like, there's one part on the... Part of it on the ice, which you can try to imagine that, where they get out and there is nothing, you know, it's like a total whiteout
mm-hmm.
where there's no shadows, so you can't tell, it's hard to tell what up and down is
mm-hmm.
because you can't see, there's no sky, it's all just gray or white
mm-hmm.
and Genli finds it very hard just even walking in it
mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean pretty dangerous. So I mean, you know, Estevan goes through all this, and then hearing, it's sort of interesting too that he would hear Genli's voice as his brother's voice. I guess that sort of goes to the bonds that they had formed.
Right.
So Estevan dies, and ultimately Genli is able to contact his ship. You know, Gethin does join the Ekumen.
Right.
And then Genli goes and visits Estevan's father. I forgot what the name of their hearth was. Esther? I forgot.
Something like that.
They had like different homes.
That's hearth. That was kind of nice. That the family kind of...
Yeah.
Environment was called the hearth. Because
yeah.
I guess, you know, when you're cold and you sit by a fireplace.
Yeah, you sit by a hearth, yeah. So he goes to the hearth and he meets the father and tells
him. So let's talk about Shift Grethor.
I don't know what Shift Grethor is. I read the whole book. I don't know.
So in terms of the intrigue, right? I have no idea what it is either, really.
Yeah.
And the comparison has been, it's like face in Japanese oriental cultures. That
mm-hmm.
that kind of an idea.
I sort of get this. So, because, you know, I studied Japanese for a long time in college, and you and I went to Japan.
Yeah.
Japanese culture sort of has like an honor...
Right.
thing, and you have to be like very polite and stuff like that, to be, you know, to abide by the honor code. And it sort of is like that unspoken kind of respect thing. So that's sort of like what
Yeah,
she
like so that
gathered.
the whole going back to Karhide thing was, what they would say is that the king would call the commensals and say, "So where's the envoy?" And they would say, "Oh, sorry, he got sick and died."
Right.
And Karhide King would say, "Really? Because he just showed up here."
Yeah. Right, and they always describe it as playing Shiv-Grethur or like playing at Shiv-Grethur. So yeah, it's a sort of like face, like I guess that's like the best
It's like
English.
a manners
Yeah.
kind of certain kind of manner,
Right,
yeah.
and it's like your I guess your reputation sort of,
Sort of,
and
yeah.
it's very odd. And that's, I mean, the reason I guess it's odd to us is because it's odd to Gendlyn. We get a lot of it through his point of view, and he really doesn't not get Shiv-Grethur. He's got like they're all the way out on the ice together for
And
months, and he
they
doesn't get
have some
Shiv-Grethur.
interesting, I guess, manners conventions. Like they say, you're not allowed to give advice, kind of directly.
Right.
It's like always indirect.
Right. Well, I mean that's sort of, I mean I could that's yeah, that's sort of similar to like in Japan you're not supposed to like really tell people what to do. It's inappropriate, for example, it's impolite to point. For example, in Japan, and you're not supposed to like point at stuff. It's like too direct at the person, and so it's like a politeness thing. So it's similar, but yeah, that's what Shiv-Grethur is apparently, and Gendlyn doesn't get it, and I don't get it.
Well, you have probably lived on that planet for a while.
Yeah, I'd have to go there and spend some time with them. So let's see. We talked about some cool science fiction stuff with Mindspeak, the Ansible. Was there any other besides the gender switching stuff? Was there any other like cool, like science fiction-y ideas that came out of this?
Well, some of like the I like the stove that they use when they
Oh,
travel, right?
yeah.
So they had this little stove that could act as a lamp, a heater, a cook
Cook
stove,
stove, yeah.
and it had some kind of fuel in that lasted for like months.
Yeah, it lasted for like over a year. It was, yeah. And it was like the. It was kind of sad because he had to sell it at the end. So they had it. They bought it prior to going out on the ice. They used it the whole trip. Without it, they would have died. It
Of
was their
course.
only source of heat. And when they get to Karhide, they have to sell it.
Right,
And
because what he needs to contact his ship, and the only way to do it is through radio. So he buys some time at radio station. Now, what in terms of technologies existing on this world is they don't have TV, they have radio.
Right. Right, because it's easier to have radio than it
Yeah,
is have
radio is a lot
TV.
simpler.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of their technologies are built on surviving the winter.
They do have electric cars.
Yeah, they did have electric cars. I don't know, it was so strange. They didn't have a lot of animals. They
Right,
didn't,
there
right.
were no. Like horses or cows or something,
Right. Yeah, because like when they're going over the ice, they don't like try to get an oxen to pull the thing. They just pull it themselves. Like they pull their own sledge as they go. Yeah, there's no really big animals, which I guess gets to that whole idea, which I guess we could talk about now, the origin of the Githenians, the idea that they descended from humans. You know, that's sort of problematic. For a lot of reasons, right? For like real science reasons, for that not being really viable.
It's kind of, there are some species of animals that can become one sex or the other, but not at the mammalian level.
Right.
So
I mean, would it have worked if they, if there had been like a native population that bred with colonist humans?
it's interspecies breeding is usually result if possible at all, usually results if in offsprings that are sterile. So
Right.
probably not. You could,
Yeah.
well, you could do genetic manipulation, right? So if you have technology to fiddle with the DNA, then you could probably do lots more stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to for I so my thing about the descending the Githenians descending from humans is the only point of view we really get that theory from is from the human point of view, right? So Gendlyn alludes to it, and then there's the chapter about it's like field notes from the first expedition because they prior to Gendlyn going to Gethin there was like some other expedition that had happened prior that had studied the planet first, and so it's all human point of views that are saying, oh well, these people it must have been descended from us, and one of the things that Ursula Le Guin does in the book is play with the point of view structure. We have from Gendlyn's point of view, Estraven's point of view, and then we get these like field notes or
Or myths.
folklore, yeah, myth kind of things. And it might very well just be that it's it's incorrect that they're descended from humans. Right. It might just be that they're their own independent.
The impression species. I got is that wasn't that were not so much descended, but actually they took humans and fiddled with their genetics and then just
and left them there.
Yeah,
I was looking. It's still sort of descended from them. It's genetically
well,
related
and descended from those genetically modified yeah. ones. And there were, yeah. there wasn't any interbreeding or anything.
I mean, yeah. I mean, whether there was interbreeding or not, I don't know if it's just that's Genly's point of view, and that's what they think happened, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily true.
Right.
You know, I don't know because I mean, is it totally bonkers to think that in the entire universe there's potentially another humanoid species? I mean, in this universe, it seems to be 80, right? There's 80.
Right, but I mean, the implication there is that they all started from one place.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
and
okay,
they spread,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, maybe that's what the humans think happened. But you'd think if you as humans did that, there would be some kind of record of you.
Well, it's
doing that.
It's thousands of years ago, so you know.
Still.
Right. So, which is like that the archives be, yeah. of Ecumen have something or other, which is what they're mentioning. But
right.
you know, maybe the archives blew up at some point. You know, somebody burned the Library of Alexandria Ecumen or something.
I mean, yeah. I guess it could. I could come up with explanations for it. In terms of the point of view thing, I love point of view stories. That's what my big thing is, A Song of Ice and Fire. That's the books that Game of Thrones is based on. Read the books, they're better. And that's all point of view.
Well, I noticed it this time around, which I don't remember noticing it before, is that like the especially part on the ice is like the chapters alternate
mm-hmm.
between the two of them.
Yep.
And that was very effective, I thought. Yeah.
Oh, it's very effective, absolutely. And you get to sort of see their thoughts on each other. And then their interpretations of the world. So one of the interesting things about it, what year was this book written?
69. Wasn't published.
So the main character, Genly, has what I think we could fairly call some pretty sexist views about men and women.
Yeah.
You know, from Earth.
But, so the way this comes up is at some point, they're sitting in the storm in a tent in the middle of the glacier and they're just chatting
mm-hmm.
and Estravan asks Genly about women and
yeah.
and what he says is kind of what today would be considered pretty sexist.
Yeah, I think I highlighted it. It's like he's like, yeah, they're different.
They're like a different species,
but
you know,
they,
who
you
knows
know,
what they want, you know.
They don't tend to be like mathematicians or anything, so I
right,
don't know.
Right.
It's kind of funny actually. But I mean my you know, initially when you read a book you think you know, maybe the author's trying to tell you what they feel, but I don't think that's the case. I think it's Genly. So here's the, he's asked about what humans are like, and he says, this is Genly. I suppose the most important thing, the heaviest single factor in one's life, is whether one's born male or female. In most societies, it determines one's expectations, activities, outlook, ethics, manners, almost everything. Vocabulary, semiotic usages, clothing, even food. Women tend to eat less. It's extremely hard to separate the innate differences from the learned ones. Even where women participate equally with men in society, they still, after all, do all the childbearing and so most of the child-rearing. And then he sort of goes on about how they're not mathematicians or composers of music or inventors.
Yeah.
Not something that we would endorse nowadays.
Well, it's kind of funny because the 60s were kind of the sexual revolution, you know. The
mm-hmm.
birth control kind of became widely
mm-hmm.
spread around then.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's interesting.
And that's
yeah.
when... crime-wise, that's when sexual assaults and things like that actually started to be reported and prosecuted
mm.
and more frequently. So, yeah, I mean, it's sort of interesting. But so when I was first reading it, I was wondering if that was Ursula Le Guin and
mm-hmm.
just the time she was writing in and, like, her thoughts because of that, or that was intentional because it was Genly's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was intentional because it was Genly's point of view.
Right.
Because it pops up throughout the book, and it's, like, so blatant, and it's, like, so, like, obviously
all
on
else.
The surface. Oh, throughout. He makes comments in the beginning about he describes his landlady who seems to is a Gathenian who seems to have, like, basically a big butt, so he says
right.
that the
oh,
Gathenian reminds him of a woman, and he mentions all the time how Estravan has these feminine qualities that he doesn't like.
Yeah.
He's always negatively speaking. Like, he talked about Gathenians, and he said Gathenians did not go to war because all Gathenians have, like, vendettas, assassinations, murders, quarrels, but they don't go to war. They've never had a war. And he says the Gathenians lacked, it seemed, the capacity to mobilize. They behaved like animals in that respect, or like women. They did
oh.
not behave like men or ants. He says stuff like that throughout. I highlighted
yeah.
some of
yeah,
it, but then
yeah.
I lost my
okay.
highlighter. he makes all kinds of comments, but they're very, that's the thing, is they're so blatant that
maybe it was on purpose, kind of, just to show that sexist attitude versus this culture where it doesn't exist.
Exactly.
Like, I mean, the thing about him not trying not to cry, or like he was always trying to be the strong one when they were going up the mountains.
Right? Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely it. It's sort of like, what does Genli do with all this masculinity he has, just, you know, by his nature, and going into this culture that totally does not care about his masculinity?
Right.
It's like, I
don't know if you noticed at the very end when the ship comes down and his compatriots come out.
And the women come out.
Yeah, and he's all confused.
He's like, I haven't seen a woman in 3 years. I don't know what to do. I'm shaking her hand. I'm confused. She's touching me. They gave him hugs, and he was like, they're giving me hugs. I don't know. So it was sort of interesting use of the point of view structure. I liked that. I thought that was good.
So what was your favorite part?
My favorite part was the foretelling. I thought that was really cool. That was when he goes and asks the question. I like the lore about people asking the wrong questions. And there was like that side story too. Somebody asked like, what was the meaning of life or something? And everybody died.
And somebody's head blew up. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like somebody exploded. It was like a little side piece in there. I thought that was pretty interesting in how they seemed to be harnessing, I guess, or focusing their natural telepathic abilities that they didn't realize they had.
Right.
And that's something Genli talks about towards the end too.
Right. He says, I have hunches. And they told him, maybe you should explore that ability more. Maybe, you know.
Right, exactly. And that humans had... and it's sort of an interesting idea that, like, humans had always had this ability, but nobody ever knew anybody else who had it. Nobody knew how to train it, that kind of thing. And so he was sort of, Genli sort of looking onto the species.
So it's also kind of equivalent to, like, the mind speak, because his mind speak is something humans innately have, but you have to learn it.
Right, exactly. So he's looking onto the species, and he's seeing that happening. But he can't exactly train them in it. But he does, when the foretellers are doing their prediction, he does connect to them and he sees, like, the crazy images they have. It's like a woman screaming the word yes, which is the answer to the question.
Well, was it a woman or a man?
He describes it as a woman in armor. Mm. So I don't know. I don't know. It's what he said. From his point of view, who knows? What was your favorite part of the story?
My favorite part was, of course, the trip over the glacier. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the part I remember was, you know, especially when there was that, like, the whiteout, where I try to imagine that. Or when he described some of the, how cold it was, that his ice froze up.
Mm-hmm. He said at one point that if you weren't careful, your nose would freeze.
Right.
And so you'd have to breathe in through your mouth, and it'd be so cold, it would be like daggers, like breathing daggers.
Right, oh, his eyes froze closed, so Estragon had to like breathe on his eyes to unfreeze them, so
he kept getting
kind of hard to imagine that kind of cold.
I don't know, we've been getting a lot of snow. I think it's kind of similar.
in the BBC version of the story, like when he's kidnapped by the secret police, to stay sane, he's trying to remember all the 62 words for snow.
Yeah.
So we haven't talked about the title.
Oh, yes. We want to talk about the title. I feel like there's something here, but I just can't get at it.
Yeah, I outlined the little poem that they have.
So the title is The Left Hand of Darkness, and that's from a poem or a phrasing Ursula wrote. Oh, you have it there. Okay, good. Do you want to read it?
Yeah, you read it.
Oh, you want me to read it? So this is a phrase that's within the story, and it's, light is the left hand of darkness, and darkness the right hand of light. Two are one, life and death, lying together like lovers in Kemmer, like hands joined together, like the end and the way. So it's a very yin-yang kind of.
Yeah, well, right, so that's, I think that was when they were talking about that kind of stuff.
And he draws the yin-yang.
Because they talk about, like, the duality between the man and woman and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So it's sort of interesting. So then the title of the book is The Left Hand of Darkness, which is out of that first line. It says, light is the left hand of darkness. Mm-hmm. So light is the left hand of darkness. So the title, The Left Hand of Darkness,
means light.
So why that instead of the second line, darkness, the right hand of light? Like the title could have easily been, instead of the left hand of darkness, it could have been the right hand of light. They both sound cool.
I think it sounds cooler.
You think this one sounds cooler?
Well, the other thing is, there's this creation myth that is they talked about. There's the two brothers who pledge Kemmer to each other, which is two siblings, I should say.
Right.
and that's a taboo.
Well, you can do
They can
it.
mate, but you cannot,
You can do it till you have one child, but you can't stay together after
right?
that or
And then
something.
one of them commits suicide and winds up being like in the inside, live inside the blizzard, and somebody's hand gets frostbitten,
Frozen.
and it's the
The
left
left
hand.
hand. I don't know. I feel like there's something there. I might have to read it again to get at it. But, I mean, it might have just been because it sounded cool.
I don't know. Sometimes, from what I've read, is that authors don't necessarily pick the titles. Sometimes the editors
Oh,
pick
yeah.
the titles. But
I don't know. I mean, it clearly ties to one of the main themes because it has to do
yeah,
with the duality and the yin and
right,
yang.
right.
But I wonder if it's saying, because the book is sort of equally about Genli and Estravin,
Yeah.
right? So it's like Genli's our initial main character, but Estravin gets
Yeah.
a lot of
Yeah.
chapters and a lot of attention as well. So I'm wondering which one of them is the left hand of darkness and which one of them is the right hand of
Right hand.
light, you know? I don't know. That's what I'm thinking in terms of the title, that the title's meant to be
Well,
a reference to
okay,
one.
so if you want a kind of silly interpretation, right? So Genli was a black man, right?
Oh yeah.
And Estravan was the light, so he's the left hand of darkness.
Oh. A
Yeah.
very literal interpretation.
Right.
I mean, that could work.
It's just a cool sounding title, though.
It is a cool sign. If it didn't even appear in the story, I would still think it was a cool sounding title. Do you want to talk about least favorite things? Do you have a least favorite thing? I have an issue, but it's not like a moment or a character or anything. It's just like a passing thought.
Not particularly. I think some of the intrigue was kind of unclear. Why things like why did Estravan get banished?
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
But you have to. I guess you have to understand Shiv Greho.
Well, that there we go.
So,
That's
in
that's the
that
scapegoat for everything. You're like, it's Shiv
way.
Gutha, you don't get it. We're not Gathenian. The only problem I had with it was it was a really interesting commentary on gender and really interesting exploration of what a society would be like without permanent gender. So they do have gender, but it just sort of depends on what's going on. And that's a really interesting idea. But in doing that, the text, and I believe it was a Genli point of view chapter, so I don't know if this was Ursula Le Guin just sort of brushing it to the side or Genli brushing it to the side, but there's a point where they say that like there's no gaze on Gethin because it's like not biologically possible because once one becomes male, the other will always become female. And I'm like, that's not really an adequate explanation. What if you just have a gay Gethenian and when the person he's chemering with becomes female, she also becomes female, you know, or the male and male. It's like
Right.
I don't see how
Well,
sort of,
maybe that
you
they
know.
said, I guess if you want to argue against it, this idea is that it's chemistry. So it's like, once one expresses certain kinds of hormones, the opposite hormones are,
That was the that's one of the
so
same
it's
arguments.
physical, and
Right, that's
then
what they
but you
said.
can just get four of them together and then just swap.
Oh. Well, that's what the text basically says. It's because it's like hormonal, so the hormones react or
Right.
whatever. But that was like that's one of the like really old school arguments for why like gay people don't exist because it's hormonal. It's the chemical. You're only attracted to the opposite or whatever, and that's just not the case. So I think
Well,
that.
but in this case, there were physical changes to the body, I guess, when he went to camera, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think she probably could have explored it more. If this was a book that was written now, I think two things. I think that would have been explored more, and I think Genli and Estravan totally would have hooked up in that tent. I don't think that they would have stopped at "we can't touch each other because then we'll be alien to each other." Like that wouldn't have happened. If it was a modern story, I
Sometimes you have to stop.
think. So, okay. So I mean, like, in conclusion, I think we hit on most of the big stuff.
So, do you think the book aged well?
Except for what I was just talking about in terms of I think she could have explored the gender issue more and the sexuality issue more, but I think it's still pretty solid. I would
Yeah.
love to see it adapted as a movie.
Really?
I think it'd be so interesting because they could drum up like a whole slew of actors who are like
Oh, so
gender neutral.
yeah, one comment I should have made, which struck me when I listened to the BBC version, is that all the Gathenians were voiced by women.
Right.
And it just, I don't know, it just makes much more of an impression when you hear it, when then if the audiobook was read by a man. And so that kind of, I guess, highlights that whole idea. So you get total different perspective.
Yeah, it's difficult for humans to think of another gender, and it's like now we're starting to understand that gender is on like a spectrum or whatever. and this whole concept that we have two distinct genders sort of is older. So I wonder how, like, if this were to be rewritten for a modern audience, how that would be different. We obviously don't have gender like Athenians do.
Right.
Because they have, like, they're all basically gender fluid. That's basically what they are.
Really
gender fluid. So, like, super fluid. Like, it's 100% fluid.
They know how to do it.
Yeah. So that, I mean, I think it aged pretty well. I think a lot of the themes are...
Yeah, I think the only thing I noticed this time around was just his sexism.
But yeah, I think it was intentional. I really do. Because you've read other Ursula Le Guin stuff. Is she like a rampant sexist in her
book? No, not at all.
No, I think that was intentional, particularly to make him different from Estevan and Estevan's chapters. And to sort of color how important gender is to the way Genly thinks, right? Like everything he thinks about. Right. He's constantly thinking about this gender issue. He like can't get it out of his head.
Right.
Estevan thinks about it, but not
with
everything, you know, not with every interaction. And I liked it. I liked the book. I thought it was good.
I'm glad I made you read it.
So let's talk a little bit about continuing our podcast, History in Reverse. We're going to read another science fiction book. And you had suggested that we pick a theme for the next couple of books. You want to explain that theme?
So the theme would be just unusual aliens, right? Mm-hmm. So here we had Githanians who were, as opposed to Star Trek aliens, which is just green.
Which are just humans with pain, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So the in my eternal quest to get Caroline to read Lem, I suggested that we do Solaris, which is not very long.
He's been trying to get me to read Solaris for years. I've read Lem before, haven't I?
Yeah, you've read some stuff.
He's the one that was he the one that it was that Philip K. Dick the
Philip
one
Philip K. Dick
yeah I read something by Philip K. Dick when I was younger and I think I told you it was like he pulled the rug out from under me and then he pulled out the whole house and it was like I love that crazy description. It was like really really weird. So we'll so Solaris is good. You don't know what year Solaris was written, do you? Was
it also in the 60s, about early 60s.
Okay. And that has to do with communication with alien, right?
Yeah, aliens. There's a very unusual alien.
Okay.
And Solaris.
So, that should be fun. Yeah, so that's what we'll be doing next time. I guess that's... Any final thoughts on Left Hand of Darkness?
No, I enjoyed it.
It was good. If you haven't read it, you should. Now you know what it's about. If you have any ideas for what the title is about...
Let us know.
Yeah, let us know. Write it somewhere, and we'll find it somehow.
Yep.
Because I'm sure someone has written an essay on it. There must be an English major somewhere in the world that has written an essay on the title. all right, so that's it. That was our podcast. Thank you so much for joining us for History in Reverse. We'll see you guys next time. Bye.
Bye.
Distance.
So speak. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello,
this is
welcome.
Sound check.
This is a sound check.
Sound check.
Let me actually sit where I'm going to be sitting so we can get a sound check. Okay, this is a sound check. This
so
is
you
about,
can see the little things there.
This is about recording. As loud as I talk. Okay. See if we. And we got to try not to touch the table while we're recording.